Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present, with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
The Germans will stick to their rigid formation of picking up individual players in defence.
Well, Holland's still had the ball, Craig going all the way on his own, brought down to the back, Sanchez made it, points to the spot, got him out, brought him down, that's the first time when Johan Cruyff was on the hesitating me. Jack Taylor points to the spot, we're in the first minute of the game, Johan Cruyff brought down, Neeskens has the ball. There was no doubt about that one. Neeskens, 1-0 Holland, and the ground erupts. That was very nearly the fastest goal ever scored in a World Cup final match. In fact, it was scored the fastest 1938, a Swede did it 35 seconds. But that's inside a minute. Meyer went right, Neeskens drilled it right down the middle. Well, what a sensational start to this game, Al.
Hello and welcome to the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield and today we are back with another episode of the My Side series. Too often football is seen as tribalistic, as fans display blinkered obsession for their football team and make outlandish claims via terrorist chants that their team is by far the greatest team the world has ever seen. However, within these claims of blind faith and devout following lies eras and teams which crystallise why supporters love their team or are prepared to suffer the recurring heartache. On even rarer occasions, you find a fan of football who can see the beauty and excellence in a side who lies beyond the confines of their own club's history. My Side is an in-depth discussion with a different guest each episode about a side that made an eternal impression upon them, either a club side over a single season or an international side at a major championships, discussing the key protagonists, the major incidents, the legacy and much more. My Side is the personal story of a love affair between a football fan and a side that defines their love of the beautiful game. And I'm delighted to say that my co-host for this series is my good friend and kindred spirit and a very happy and jubilant Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, any point in asking you how you are?
Oh, I'm very well, Stu.
Yeah,
I'm
I bet you are.
Indeed. Yeah, I'm absolutely loving it at the minute. I can't deny it. It's great. It's just been one of the best. It's been the best winter for many winters.
I can't even begin to what it must be like. What it must be like to live in Liverpool at the moment. Well, the red half of Liverpool, anyway.
No, it's brilliant. They've been a privilege to watch, and they're just jaw dropping every week. And you know, I don't say that lightly. You know, I've got to, over those years, I've watched a lot of great Liverpool side, some poor ones as well. But, you know, I grew up, my first inklings of football were largely centred around that 78-79 side that won the title so convincingly and metronomically. And then I was probably at my most impressionable, I'd probably say, when that 87-88 side, Barnes, Beardsley and Aldridge, you know, did what they did. And now I'm getting to see this, and yeah, spoiled. But, you know, to end a 30-year drought for the title and end it in the fashion that they're looking likely to do, privilege, utter privilege.
Should we ever be lucky enough to run for another 15 years of this series, which is highly unlikely, or if we have a reunion, there may well be somewhere a podcast that runs a similar series that may well talk about this Liverpool side.
Oh yeah, we'll pencil this up for 15 years. We'll give it a bit of time for the dust to settle. But yeah, in fact, we should really kind of like do it now and then just release it 15 years from
yes.
Now.
Oh, that's a far better idea.
Yeah,
technology will be way beyond us by then. We'll have no chance.
Yeah, like a time capsule and then just crack it open, kind of like, 30, 40, 50 years from now, something like that.
Brilliant. Obviously, tonight's, you know, talking of great sides, looking forward to this one?
Oh, yeah, massively. Again, you know, another another side that just play a football the way it should be played. And this is the side, really, you know, that we're talking about here, certainly in international terms, in a European context, you know, has there ever been a better European international side? Yet, you know, they didn't achieve their goal, you know, which is always that great what if, you know, of European football, international football, is that, you know, this team did not achieve their goal, but how did they not do that? You know, such a brilliant side, the right man to talk about them.
It absolutely is, and the guest we've got on is not bad at this podcast in Lark. We've had him on a couple of times, haven't we? He's all right.
We've had him on a couple of times. I don't think there'll be any nerves for this one.
No,
and he's going to be fine with us tonight.
It's today's guest, and to be fair, it's quite a unique position in that he's actually making his second appearance on this series, which, to begin with, shouldn't really be allowed, and is actually against the rules. However, based on the fact that his first appearance on this series was to do with the European success of Ajax, it's more or less, he's got through the back door, really, with an extension of what went on to be an international term. So that's how he's managed to get himself a second appearance.
He's got a license for these, so, you know, we had no choice.
We had no choice. So... tonight's guest is Mr. Gary Thacker, who is going to be talking about, for me, the third part of the unholy trinity of great sides never to win a World Cup. And we're talking about the Dutch 1974 World Cup side. And our guest tonight is Mr. Gary Thacker. Gary, how are we?
Evening, guys. I'm good, thank you, Marty, and delighted to be back. And I've got through any door that's open for me, guys.
obviously, we had you on, and to be fair, the Ajax episode was incredibly popular. And I think before we go into this Dutch eulogy, Gary, that I have no doubt is coming our way over the next hour, there is something, isn't there, about Dutch football and Dutch football in the 70s that just seems to capture the imagination of football fans everywhere.
There is. It was a time, you know, the late 60s were sort of the summer of love and all that sort of thing. And, you know, Dutch football was almost like a part of the counterculture that was prominent at the time. They were rebellious. They were out of the norm. They were beautiful to watch. And it almost became a special thing that they didn't win. Because it's difficult to become loved when you're the champion sometimes. And, you know, often when you go to a wedding, the bridesmaid's the prettiest girl there. And, you know, they were the bridesmaids in 1974, but by God, they were pretty to watch.
Such fantastic analogies. If it's not artists, it's bridesmaids at weddings. They just get better and better, I'm not going to lie. So, obviously, Gary, you know, the listeners know you very well. You know, you're with us. Well, you know, the three of us are always together on these sorts of things. But for anybody who is tempted to be listening for the first time, and we're always happy to get new listeners. I suppose a little bit about yourself, your love of football, and why, you know, why this particular side.
Sure. Well, I'm a Chelsea fan, and, you know, anybody who listens regularly will know that for more than 50 odd years. You know, the club football, Chelsea, they're like my drug, and like some addicted narcotic craze fool. You know, I love them in equal measure. And off at the same time, you know, with apologies to Lou Reed, they've given me some perfect days as well, one particularly on the 19th of May 2012. But, you know, when I picked the club side, it was difficult to pick a Chelsea team of, you know, of 11 out of those sort of 50-odd years. So I plumped for Ajax and the Dutch national team for the same sort of reason, because at that time, so we're talking the early 70s, I was in my sort of formative years of adopting a creed of football, a way to play, a belief in a system, a joy of watching the game, of how it should be, you know, and the Dutch for me captured all that. So in 1974, the Dutch became, in my humble opinion, and I know, you know, you would argue the case for Brazil 82, and Stephen would say the Danish dynamite team, but for me, in 1974, the Dutch became the best team never to win the World Cup.
Ooh, Gary, I might have to cut you off. okay, we'll go with it. I'm happy for you to. I'm always open to the to such discussions.
And I'm happy for you to convince me.
Yeah. I'm happy to be convinced.
Okay.
Sorry, just before I go.
In 74, there were. I mean, the 74 World Cup was sort of an iconic tournament, and that there was three outstanding teams in that tournament: the Dutch and the Poles, who finished second and third, and obviously the German team, the hosts, who won it. The Poles lost out to West Germany in a swimming pool of a pitch, where their football was compromised more than Germans was, and the Germans' football was, and they lost out by in a terrible way to lose a semi-final. And they were a wonderful side, the Poles. And the Poles against the Dutch in the World Cup final would have been an absolute fiesta of football, but it wasn't to be. And obviously the Dutch, they just got in the final and played Germany. Now, some would suggest, and I would find it difficult to offer a convincing counter-argument, that perhaps the Dutch shouldn't even have been there at that tournament. They were playing in the qualifying group alongside Belgium. And in the last game, the Belgians, Verheyen, I think, scored a goal that was controversially disallowed for offside. And having watched the video several times, it's difficult to say that it was offside because I don't think it was. But, you know, if their invitation to the party was a little bit fortunate, that late coming to the party proved to be the bell of the ball. You know, the team, it was the nucleus of the Ajax side that dominated European club football. Cruyff was at Barcelona then, and there was a few Feyenoord players as well. So the Feyenoord obviously won the World Cup, the European Cup, a little ahead of Ajax. So they were an accomplished set of footballers. But as ever with the Dutch, there's always something not quite right for some reasons. Sometimes it's their own fault, sometimes it's not. And there was a little bit of both in this Dutch squad that arrived in West Germany. The first problem they had was the goalkeeper. Jan Youngblood was chosen to be the first choice, arguably, reportedly, allegedly, advocated by Cruyff, who thought he was a better footballer, even though he might have been the best goalkeeper, and the way they played, it would suit the player better to have Youngblood wearing the gloves rather than what we'd say a more proficient goalkeeper, perhaps. And the other problem they had, which wasn't of their own making, was that they were missing Barry Hulshof. And anybody who's listened to me talking about Dutch football or football generally, you know Barry Hulshof is an all-time hero of mine, absolute titan of a defender. And although the picture the Dutch painted was still wonderful, it wasn't complete because there was part of the jigsaw that were missing. One part didn't fit and one part was missing, although the picture they painted in the tournament was still beautiful, even though it was incomplete.
It's a very convincing opening, Gary, I'm not going to lie.
Thank you.
It's, and, you know, as we said, Brazil had their own problems with their number nine and their goalkeeper as well, but this is about you. It's not about me and my team, it's about you and your team. Stephen, for you, you know, before Gary continues to convince us of his argument, you know, the Dutch of 74, they're almost, it's almost a mythical cast of players on the stage.
Oh, it is. I mean, I think that one of the most iconic things about this side is that there was no pedigree at international level prior to this. You know, they went into the 1974 World Cup as the favourites in the eyes of many. And that's kind of like on West German soil against the team who were the reigning world European champions, you know, who'd reached the World Cup semi-final in 1970, played in the World Cup final in 66, had a World Cup to the name in 54, you know, being there, done it. So to be able to say that there's this big, huge football-playing nation with the pedigree who are hosts, yet to turn around and say that here are these kind of like international tournament novices that are coming along and this is the team that's going to win it. And that just says everything about the standing of that side and what Ajax have done as a European Cup-winning side and dominated the tournament for a good few seasons. But yeah, it was just a side dripping with talent. You know, the names that trip off the tongue, you know, Cruyff at the top of them, but not just them, but, you know, Rep and Rensenbrink, you know, Kroll, you know, so many of these iconic players that just kind of like stick in the mind and you know are just absolutely iconic, you know. And but one of the things is that there was a great collectiveness there. You know, there was only of the seven games they played, only 12 players started, and one of those only started one game. You know, and I think that's one of the great kind of like overlooked things about this side. There was a huge amount of players in it that didn't have a great deal of experience. You know, Gary's already mentioned Jan Youngblood. You know, he'd only played twice going into the finals, and he wasn't the only one. You know, there were quite a few that only had a few caps to the name. Johnny Rapid only played five times. You know, Vin Riesberger at the back, you know, who stepped in to play, you know, he was 22, he'd played once. But it was the way that this great, you know, confidence was there for these players to fit in and say, yeah, well, yeah, you will work. But it was a blank canvas as well, because Meikles didn't take them to the finals. He didn't get them there. He just picked up the baton before the finals and said, right, let's see what we can do with this. And I think it just all worked to bring this great kind of, you know, melting pot together to say, well, look, you know, we're not saddled down by history. You know, we have a great present, and here's what we can do.
It's an interesting point, actually, that we'll probably come back to about we have no history, and then from 74, as and I'm sure Gary alluded to later on when we talk about legacy, what actually came about from this having nothing to lose. But before we do that, then, Gary, I suppose, you know, leading up to the tournament, you know, you've talked about maybe looking to qualify, perhaps not so much being there, but was this a... Obviously, you know, you mentioned, you know, in the previous episode about this Ajax side, and Steve has just mentioned it there about this, you know, what Ajax were doing in club football on the continent. Was this side evident? Was there a real sort of swathe across Europe that this Dutch side were going to be something special coming into this tournament?
Well, yeah, because of the success of Feyenoord and lastly of Ajax, that was almost inevitable. And just to sort of emphasise how exceptional this was. The last time previously to 1974 that the Dutch qualified for a World Cup finals tournament was 1938. And they reached the final in 74. 4 years later, they reached the final again in 78, and then didn't qualify again for a tournament until 1990. So in 52 years, they qualified for two tournaments and got to the final both times, and both times lost to the host country. So, you know, this wasn't like... perhaps people of a sort of more tender age, the last sort of five or six tournaments will sort of think, well, the Dutch always qualify, or they normally qualify, they're one of the regulars, they're one of the big teams. But that wasn't the case. 1974 was the first time the Dutch really attended a tournament with any kind of pedigree. And, you know, as Steve was alluding to earlier, you know, they were fancied to do really well there. The Germans, who were hosting the tournament, obviously, a host is always going to be a prime contender. And they had lost a Titanic semi-final against Italy in 1970 in Mexico. And, you know, they had it was the last hurrah for some of the German players of that sort of era as well. But the Dutch team that turned up for the tournament had a host of stars, and you know they as you know Steve has mentioned all rattled through the team afterwards. But you know only one, and it's quite right, only one player didn't play regularly. That was Pete Kaiser, the Ajax player. He played once, and that was the only time that Meikles changed the team, because there was such a wonderful collection of players.
Stephen, I don't know where you sit on this. I suppose it's something we talk about relatively regularly. And this, and I suppose Gary mentioned it, you know, a little bit at the beginning, but not winning. So you know, this side, as Gary's mentioned, they almost, you know, if you look through the history books, they have literally come from nowhere with regards to World Cup pedigree up to 1974, and then you know this beautiful side, as you know, as Gary says, and he's right. They are a beautiful side. Arrive and lose when every part of you tells you that they should have won. Do you think that the mythology behind this side is greater because they don't win and they come so close?
Yeah, I do. You know, it's. You know, I really do. It's like Brazil 1970. You know, they win with, you know, huge amounts of beauty, and they are celebrated. But are they as celebrated from a European perspective? I think if you look at, well, Brazil 70, not even in Brazil are they kind of, you know, lauded in the way that they are in Europe. So it is, you know, down to the fact that they won that. You know, they won it with great beauty, but it was kind of like, well, yeah, that's what we did. So for the Netherlands to come along and do a Europeanized version of that, but fall short, you know, it does make the story in the end.
It's, I mean, obviously, Gary, we're, you know, it's when we do this series and we look at, you know, a lot of it is usually club sides, and it's the buying and selling of players, the arrival of players at the start of a season. But obviously it's slightly different when we talk about it from a major tournament perspective. But obviously coming into 74, and, you know, you've mentioned quite, you know, already relatively inexperienced internationals and obviously no experience with regards to playing major tournament football on a World Cup level. So, you know, coming into this tournament, you know, was the timing right for some of these players? Was there an arrival of key players that just made this work?
Yeah, there were, and Steve mentioned two of them I'll flag up. One was Royce Bergen, who was a 22-year-old Feyenoord centre-back. And I'll tell you why he sort of was important in a second. And the other one was Johnny Recker became the teeny bop idol of that team. Flowing blonde hair, wonderful footballer, goal scorer. The thing with Rijsbergen was that the Dutch had this, you know, defences, I wouldn't say defences for wimps, but you know what I mean. They played wonderful football. All the players had to be footballers. There was no joint centre-half that couldn't play. He hit the ball. There was no sort of tricky right winger who could only go one way. They were all great footballers. And the big loss, as I mentioned earlier, was Hulshof. And going into the World Cup tournament, Mikkel had a little bit of a dilemma. Hulshof had always had a difficult relationship with Mikkel when he was at Ajax. Gone far better with Stefan Kovacs after Mikkel's moved on to Barcelona. This guy played in three European Cup finals without conceding a goal in his defence. He played a dozen, I think, might be 13 times for Holland. Scored six goals from centre-back. Six goals in, I think, 12 or 13 games. That's how important this guy was. And when he was injured, Mikkels was scouting about for an alternative, and he looked at a guy called Rinus Israel, who was also injured, had a knee problem. He took him to the World Cup, and he came as a substitute, I think, in a couple of games, or one game at least. But the option he chose in the end was to put a midfield player, Ari Hahn, alongside Rijsbergen. So basically, Rijsbergen, at 22 years old, with two or three caps going into this tournament, was the sole defender in the middle of the sole professional defender, shall we say, in the middle of the Dutch defence. Now, how good was that? Well, basically, until the final, the Dutch conceded one goal, a single goal, and it was an own goal by Ruud Krol when they, I think, were 4-0 up in against Bulgaria in the last few minutes of the game. So it was a masterstroke by Mikkels to put Ari Hahn in there. He had a guy who could bring the ball out of the defence because he was a midfield player by profession, and also it worked well to keep the back door locked as well. But much of that, of course, was because the Dutch were that good. The ball was at the other end of the park so much of the time.
I mean, listening to Gary there, Stephen, it's, you know, and the sort of the moving of Ari Hahn. Do you think that there's an element of the way the Dutch have played the game, and certainly the way they played the game in 74? And, you know, and again, we can look back at the club football and, you know, and their philosophy there. But do you think that the way the Dutch play, the way the Dutch train, the philosophy that they play with allowed the Dutch side of 74 to be able to do that? You know, I mean, it's not, for me, I don't think it's something that would be possible really in maybe any other or many other international sides, where they can move their players around the pitch to accommodate positions or injuries or, you know, absentees.
Not to the extent that they did. There were exceptions. You know, you would often get a team who would have a player who could fit in absolutely anywhere. You know, Liverpool in the 1960s, unlike Jeff Strong, you know, notoriously could play anywhere along the back line, anywhere across the midfield, and push up front if needs be. And I think every team, it was the utility player. You know, so every team would have, you know, a player who was a jack of all trades, but not to the point that what they were doing, they would be able to. And it wasn't just a case of kind of like, you know, in a stringent kind of, this is our pattern, this is our formation, and you will play at left back or you will play at centre back. You know, these were interchanging during the game. You know, there were times when Cruyff would drop in at left back, so, you know, Cruyff would come storming through. You know, this was the beauty of this team and the total football that they played. Every player was interchangeable, and it came down to the fact that this is why Jongbloed played, because, you know, Cruyff had him pinned as being a footballing goalkeeper, and, you know, so he would be comfortable with the ball at his feet and he could pick out a player. It wasn't just a case of being a shot stopper or even a penalty box goalkeeper. He wasn't the most accomplished. I mean, you could probably draw a parallel to kind of like cricket now, whereas the, you know, the role of the wicket keeper used to be simply to catch the ball behind the stumps. And, you know, if they could swing a bat, then it was a bonus, but that's not good enough anymore. So, you know, it tends to be, you know, a batsman that is trained up to be able to catch the ball. You know, batsman foremost, someone who catch the ball second. And this was almost like what they did with Jongbloed playing in goal. You know, he had, you know, a more natural footballing aspect. He wasn't the greatest goalkeeper in the world, but, you know, he could find knee skins with the ball. You know, it wasn't just a case of lumping the ball into the channels and playing the percentages. He was part of the ball playing aspect of this side. And everyone, you look at that back line and they could all stride forward. You look at the midfield and they could all drop back. And they were just so, you know, it's to look at it, you know, it's futuristic, you know, and it's the template of all great sides now. You can look at the Barcelona, you know, and that's the great thing about it, is that, you know, it echoes through, you know, generations, because it's a type of philosophy that is passed on from one generation to the next. You know, Cruyff's disciple of Guardiola. Guardiola will pass it on to the players that he has coached. You know, can you really not see David Silva being a world-class coach at some point, or any one of those players that he has coached wherever he has been? Xavi Alonso came under him at Bayern Munich. You know, Xavi Alonso will be a fantastic manager. You know, he's you know, training now with Real Sociedad B side, and he'll be a manager to watch in the future. And that's just what this team were. It was, you know, a team of intelligence.
I mean, that's a great answer. You know, it's a great point, and Gary, it links us in perfectly to, you know, to the next part of this where we get to sort of chat about the manager, which is Rinus Michels. But Stephen makes a great point there, where you can it's almost like a family tree. You can trace the history back from contemporary Premiership football right back to this 1974 Dutch World Cup side, and you can see almost this unbroken lineage of development that almost starts right here in West Germany, you know, in the Dutch camp.
Yeah, well, it probably actually started before that, back in Amsterdam. Cruyff used to say about his relationship with Michels that Michels organised the team off the pitch and Cruyff organised the team on the pitch, you know, and that was very much the way they operated, and it was a mutual trust situation. And Stevie's right, you know, that sort of thing does go on, and Guardiola picked up the baton as well, you know. And another guy that perhaps Steve didn't mention is Xavi Hernandez, who has been linked with the Barcelona job, and it wouldn't be the biggest surprise in the world come the summer. This guy moves back to Barcelona and takes over the team very much in the mode that Guardiola did when he did, because his sort of career before moving to Barcelona wasn't sort of, as a managerial career, wasn't fantastic. And same with, God, brain's gone, the guy who's managing the Spanish team at the moment. Oh, jeez. Oh, dear me. When it's terrible when your brain goes. And he had a couple of jobs managing before, one in Spain, and he also managed Roma. He's now going to come back to me in a minute. I'm sorry about that. It is that sort of lineage. It creates that the sort of passing on of the baton. It happened with Kovacs as well. Kovacs was manager of the French team before Hidalgo took over, and Hidalgo obviously had created the team of the Carré Magique with Platini and Giresse and the other corners of the square. So yes, there's a lot of that that goes on, and certainly the Dutch team of 1974 was seen as an innovative team, and lots of people copied it. And you know, imitation is the most sincere form of flattery. But so many clubs found it difficult to replicate the success because they didn't have the talented players that were available to Michels at the time. And Michels only took over the Dutch team about 3 months before the finals. The guy who managed the team before was a Czech guy called Fadronk, I believe the pronunciation is correct. And because they just scraped through to the finals, the Dutch FA decided that they wanted to make sure that they were going to get full value from the talents that were available to the manager. So Michels was given the job, and obviously produced that wonderful kind of football that they did in the tournament.
In a second, Gary, like I say, we're it's almost like this works perfectly now. We're right on the half hour mark, and we're gonna get you to name your 1 to 11 in any style that you'd like to. If you want to do it in the Dutch language, that would be even better, but it's all right, there's no pressure on that.
Can we do it in double Dutch?
Yes, double Dutch would be great. Before that, you know, Stephen, just a little bit, you know, from you on Rinus Michels, and I suppose, you know, like we say, where he, you know, we're about to get from, you know, we'll get more from Gary as to, you know, to his impact throughout this tournament and on this side. But for you, Rinus Michels is a standalone, you know, character in the world game. You know, his presence is still not everywhere, but it's still keenly felt throughout football.
Oh, undoubtedly. I mean, just a thinking man's football coach. There was a, you know, perceived abrasiveness to him as well. And I think the interesting thing about this is that, you know, he when he took the Netherlands to the World Cup in 1974, he'd been away from the Danish game, for the Dutch game, for 3 years. He left for Barcelona in 1971 after they won the first European Cup. You know, and as you say, it was Stefan Kovacs that then took on the next two. But Cruyff had left for Barcelona to join Michels. So, you know, this was a World Cup that was, you know, dreamt up between Saucer and Apprentice in Catalonia, you know, while they're busy going out there and winning the La Liga title for the first time in over a decade. So there was a sense of detachment for Michels. You know, he had Cruyff by his side for the best part of 12 months leading up to the World Cup, but not the squad. You know, so, I mean, it'd be interesting to know exactly, you know, how long Michels knew that he was likely to have this job going into the World Cup beforehand. You know, did he have the year with Cruyff in Barcelona to be able to plot how the 1974 World Cup would be? It would be very Dutch of them to have done that, you know, to have kept the powder dry and say, look, you know, that Michels will come through to the World Cup finals and take them there, presumptuous of them to say that they were going to get there, because yeah, they did come so close to not being there. But yeah, that wonderful sliding doors effect of so much of this, of what might have been, it might have not been Michels, the Netherlands might not have been there at all. But yeah, when it came to it, it was almost like the clouds cleared and here is Michels with the team that he was meant to lead.
Brilliant. Okay, Gary, so, you know, talk us through the, you know, this 1 to 11, this incredibly tight unit that the Dutch, like I say, played practically the entire tournament with.
Sure. Yeah, okay, so basically, as we discussed a couple of times already, Jan Youngblood was in goal throughout the tournament, and the back line was Sorbier, Rijsberg and Harry Hahn and Ruud Krol, three Ajax players, and Rijsberg from Feyenoord. In front of them, they had Wim Jansen. Now, Wim Jansen is an offer this is the guy who managed Celtic a while ago as well, to the Scottish title. I think he's 1 year he was there. He's quite an underrated player, but he was the guy who, he was almost like the Makalele, the N'Golo Kante of the team that allowed everybody else to play. You know, he would always be the back, the sentinel at the back. And when we get to the final, the second half of the final, when the Dutch sort of bombarded the Germans for almost 45 minutes non-stop, the guy at the back was Rijsberg, was Janssen, quite often left on his own or with one other guy, and he kept that back door closed wonderfully. They were looking forward. We're talking magical players here. Johnny Rep, who we discussed earlier, Johan Neeskens, again, often sort of underrated because he's been in the shadow of Cruyff at Ajax and then at Barcelona and also in the Dutch national team, but a superb player. Van Hanegem, there again, because he didn't play for Ajax, again, is often overlooked. Wonderfully creative footballer and who fitted into this system that Mikkels played, like a hand in a glove. And then the recently sadly departed Rob Rensenbrink, who played for, it was often considered by the other Dutch players a little bit of an outsider because he played his football in Belgium for Anderlecht, and was often sort of reportedly criticised for opting out of competitive football to play in Belgium. But he's a wonderful player and fully justified his inclusion in the squad. And he was a player left out when Piet Keizer came in for that one game. And 4 years later, Rensenbrink was still in Dutch colours and came so close to being the man that took the World Cup to Holland when he hit the post in the last minute against Argentina. And obviously the guy up front was Johan Cruyff. With his extra stripe on his shirt, it's people were sort of aware because he was sponsored by Adidas, and the Dutch team weren't, so that the Dutch team had two stripes on his shirt, but he wanted the extra one because he was sponsored by Adidas, and that's sort of fairly well known, but perhaps what's less well known is 4 years later, that same extra stripe was on the shirt of Dirk Den Inker, the guy who came on as a substitute in the final and scored the equalising goal because he too was sponsored by Adidas. The Dutch team at the time, they were numbered alphabetically, except for Cruyff. Cruyff had 14. And it's a thing that was repeated 4 years later, not by the Dutch, but by the Argentinian team that won the tournament. And people may remember that. I think Ozzy Ardiles wore something like number one or number two on his shirt because he was alphabetically near the front, of course, but that was the team that played almost consistently throughout the tournament and enchanted.
It's strange, isn't it, Steve? And again, you know, I suppose I asked you the question about this mythical status based on the fact that you don't win, but obviously the West Germans go on and win it. You know, Argentina win it in 78, and sometimes it's the sides that don't win that you can rattle off those, that 1-11, you know, almost in a heartbeat, more often than not, more than a victorious World Cup winning side or major tournament winning side.
Yeah, sometimes a tournament winning side can, you know, as good as they are, sometimes they play the percentages, and that's what West Germany did in 74. They very much played the percentages. They were, you know, quite under par in the group stages. They lost to East Germany. They were booed off the pitch in Hamburg after they beat Australia 3-0 because, you know, the crowd were demanding more. And but there was also the shadow of Netzer. You know, Gunter Netzer had played so well in them winning the 1972 European Championship. And that was a much more free-flowing West German side. There was a huge amount of pressure on West Germany to succeed on home soil. And they felt they couldn't go toe-to-toe with this Netherlands side. If, you know, if you'd have put Netzer in there and tried to, you know, out-total football the Netherlands, they'd have not done it. You know, this was the right West German side to do the job. And that was what they did in 74. You know, they won in 72, the European Championship in style, and they did the job in 74.
It's, I suppose, Gary, you know, like, again, you know, you don't have players that arrive, you know, midway through a tournament. You do have moments in games where, a player is brought in and then they stay in, you know, for the rest of the tournament. But, you know, but as you've mentioned already, you know, this side pretty much played every minute of every game. So rather than players arriving midway, and, you know, you've mentioned, you know, you've mentioned young blood and the I suppose the controversial selection or omissions, but is, you know, in your opinion, was this the best 11 that was available at the time?
It was the best 10. best 10 outfield players. And I don't think, I don't think even Jan Youngblood's mother would sort of claim he was a better goalkeeper than some of the options they had. But, yeah, but you know, as I say, it's difficult to criticise a defence that concedes only a single goal getting to the final of a World Cup. You know, for a team that's sort of lauded for its attacking prowess and its wonderful flowing football moving forward, a single own goal in the last minute of a game when you're 4 points ahead and get to the World Cup final, that's the only goal you concede, is pretty good. So perhaps it's difficult to criticise, you know, Youngblood for that in the final.
What I'd say there with Youngblood is that, you know, if you ever see the footage of the Netherlands opening game with the Solomons against Uruguay in their own stud with the national anthem, Youngblood looks kind of like startled, you know, as if he can't believe he is where he is. That's one of the great. But to be fair to him, you know, he was one of three goalkeepers that had very little international football under the, you know, under the wing. You know, then, you know, even, you know, the man that is often referred to as the one who should have played, and he did play for the Netherlands in the 76 European Championship, and he played the second round games at the 1978 World Cup. He should have played in the 78 World Cup final. He got injured in what was effectively the semi-final against Italy, and it ruled him out, and it was Piet Schrijvers. But even then, you know, in 74, he'd only played a small handful of games. You know, the alternatives to Youngblood weren't all that, you know, experienced themselves.
It's true.
And I suppose, you know, we'll go through the tournament, Gary, because obviously, you know, that's sort of the next key part that we look at here, and, you know, we'll sort of go through it, and obviously, you know, we've kind of spoiled the surprise at the end, although anybody who knows their football will know how this tragic tale ends. But a couple of things before then, so, you know, you've talked about the influence of Johan, you know, of Johan Cruyff, you know, maybe a little bit more about that, but also about his part that went into this, you know, this philosophy of Dutch football, you know, the total football that people associate with this side as well. So I suppose really just a little bit of how this 11 that you've named, how they then played the game and Cruyff's influence within that.
Yeah. First, just to chuck in, the guy whose name couldn't was Luis Enrique, of course.
Just, well done,
just come back to me.
Brilliant.
I mean, so obviously I laid out the team in I want to say kickoff formation, shall we say? But you know, as Steve mentioned earlier, that was just the starting point, and the players interacted and changed so much. For example, in the final, Cruyff started that run from when he won the penalty in the first few minutes from left back. He dropped into left back. You know, as Steve was mentioning earlier, so Kroll could move further forward, and that was something that wasn't manufactured. It was something that was brought up in the Dutch school, in the Ajax way of playing. And all the players were versed in that. And because there were only two or three players not in Ajax, from Feyenoord, Rosberg and Van Hanegem, but they were one of the talented players as well and could fit into that template so easily. And it wasn't a system, although, so the manager got there 3 months ahead of the final. But it wasn't a revolutionary system he employed. Let's start from scratch, guys. I've got an idea. These players already knew how to do that sort of thing. It was the natural way they played. So it was almost like a comfort for them to be playing that way, because that's how they played throughout the club football for Ajax. So the players, the interchanging of players, and it wasn't that unusual for in fact, Kroll scored some cracking goals in the tournament from left back, as it were, nominal left back. But all the players had that ability to interchange the situation, and Cruyff would drop into the back line. Van Hanegem would drop back and alongside Janssen, and Serbia and Kroll would not overlapping forwards like in the sort of mode of, you know, I don't know, the winger sort of lobbed it around the outside for the guy to run. Perhaps a little bit like one of Stevie's guys, Trent Alexander-Arnold, who looks like a midfield player playing fullback. This was the sort of talent they had, you know, but on a world stage, they were sort of massively indoctrinated in this from a fairly early age. And because they were young players coming through, you know, Johnny Rep, as I said, was 22. It almost no different way of playing football than the Ajax way of the total football philosophy.
In terms of what Gary's just said there, Stephen, and I suppose it's similar to the question that I asked you before, but it's a question usually when you're down the pub, but it's, you know, do your philosophy the way you play, you know, do you pick players to play your philosophy, or do you look at the players you've got and end up playing in a certain way that suits their strengths?
I think there's both, you know, it just depends on the circumstances. You know, more so with club football is that, you know, a manager will walk into a club, look at the players that he's got, and then say, right, well, this is what I want to do, but, you know, maybe for the short term I will implement something that suits the players until I can get the players that will suit, you know, the style of play. It also depends on how long a manager's got, you know, is it sink or swim, you know, is it a long-term, you know, project, you know, I think that always plays its part, but yeah, there's a little of A and there's a little B there, but I think with international football and certainly sides such as the Netherlands there, you know, you say this is, you know, Meikles is saying this is my philosophy, this is what I want to do, this is how I want to play, and these are the players that fit those roles the best. And I think Youngblood, you know, being selected as goalkeeper kind of is the testament to that, really.
So, Gary, now we've got our 1-11, we've got our manager, we've got our philosophy, we've arrived just across the border in West Germany. You know, I suppose it's time to talk us through this campaign and this tournament.
Yeah, okie dokie. So the opening game was against Uruguay. Fairly comfortable victory. Johnny Rep scored two goals, and sort of it almost looked was the game that sort of made his name. And If a guy would need some confidence to go forward, I'm not sure he did need that confidence because he was such an outstanding, talented player. But scoring two goals in the European game in the World Cup finals is pretty good, and that's what he did. In the second game, Meikles made that one change, bringing Kaiser in for a Rensenbrink. The Dutch played Sweden. It was the only game that they didn't score in the game, and a 0-0 draw. But there was one moment in that game that will forever be remembered, probably more than almost any of the goals the Dutch scored in that tournament. And it was when Cruyff unveiled the turn that has ever since been sort of named after him. And the Swedish defender, a guy named Olsen, and I've been watching the games this afternoon because I knew we were going to talk about this today. And this guy, you often say, you know, so he sent him so far the wrong way, he had to buy a ticket to get back in the stadium. So this guy needed to get a taxi back to the stadium first before he could get in, because he looks absolutely bewildered. You know, when you sort of watch a magician, well, where's that gone? He's looking, almost looking around, bewildered for where the ball's gone. And that was a moment of sheer poetry by Cruyff in that game. They then did 0-0, and for the next game, Rensenbrink was brought back. And this was the Bulgaria game. That was 4-1 win. Naiskin scored a couple, another goal for Rep, and a guy called Theo de Jong, who came on as late substitute for Naiskin's, scored as well. And this was the game where Rudi Kroll's absolutely meaningless own goal was considered late on when they were 4-1 cup. And it's the only game where the Dutch actually conceded a goal up to the final. And this tournament had this second group situation. There were two groups. It was one of those weird ones where, you know what the World Cup's like in FIFA. Yeah, let's throw the ball up in the end, see what comes down. And in the second group, the Dutch were dropped into a section with Argentina, East Germany and Brazil. Obviously, Brazil were the world champions. Argentina, the game against Argentina, the Dutch was probably the most enthralling performance. And the Dutch won 4-0. The first goal that Cruyff scored was a chip played through, and the control and the balletic movement as he dances past the goalkeeper before rolling it into the onion bag is watch it on YouTube. You want to see Grace scoring a goal from a difficult situation. The ball's a little bit too far in front of him, but he brings it down majestically, dances past the goalkeeper and rolls in. Wonderful goal. And they beat the Argentines 4-0. It could have been six. It could have been anything they wanted. Cruyff was majestic. He scored two. Kroll scored and Johnny Rep scored again. When they played the East Germans, it was almost like a no contest. The East Germans had dined out on the beating their Western brethren early in the tournament, and they were comfortably outplayed, and Kroll and Rensenbrink scored two goals. And then it came to the major game, the big confrontation, where the Dutch played Brazil. Now, Brazilian football has a wonderful reputation. You know, the Jogo Bonito, and your favourite, the 1982 team, Stu.
Yeah.
This was a different animal entirely. It was almost like they turned the team into a street fighter. They didn't wear the canary shirts, or they wore blue. And the Dutch changed as well. The Dutch changed their shirts as well. They wore all white. And to say Brazil weren't recognisable as a Brazilian team wasn't just because the colours they were in. They were brutal. They kicked and hacked. They snarled and growled. The guys from Rivelino were still in the squad, but the guys from 1970, Jairzinho, Gerson, Pelé must have sort of been sadly shaking their heads at the way they played. It was almost like we're not interested in being the owners of the beautiful game anymore. We're going to win at any costs. And they didn't win, they lost. And a guy called Pereira was sent off the second foul he committed on Neeskens. I mean, people often say, oh, that's a bad challenge when somebody walks up and kicks somebody up in the air and the ball's nowhere. It's not a challenge. It's not a challenge. There's no challenge to the ball. He just walks up and kicks his legs underneath him, and quite rightly he's dismissed. Dutch scored twice. Neeskens scored, and Cruyff scored. Excuse me, the second, the killer goal. And it was a wonderful performance. It was a performance where beauty slayed the beast. If the Brazilians had won that, it would have been, I'd say the word tragedy and travesty, but it almost would have been, because they were an ugly team. They were Brazil, a beautiful team, but they played ugly football in that tournament. And it's almost fitting that they didn't wear the yellow Brazilian shirt in that day. But the Dutch overcame them. They overcame the physical approach that they were confronted with. And it's often not mentioned about the way the Dutch played when not in possession of the ball. And they'd almost got this philosophy of hunting in groups. So if a player was in possession being pressed, you wouldn't be pressed by one player, you'd be pressed by two or three. Almost like they were sort of, I say, ganging up, hunting in groups to regain possession. It happened so many times, especially in that Brazilian game. And quite often, you could see that the Brazilian players losing the rag over it, because it was difficult to retain the ball because the Dutch were buzzing around them all the time. But as I say, you know, it was beauty slaying the beast.
It's funny, because we joke sometimes about having a klaxon on here for YouTube alerts, and we'll come to the final in a second, Gary. But Stephen, the way Gary's described the Brazil Dutch game, it's almost an alert to, I can't decide whether to stay away from it, to watch it as a video nasty, or to watch it because it is truly, you would never believe that it was Brazil versus Holland in that game in Dortmund.
Yeah, if you've got a spare evening, you know, crack open a beer, you know, just sit there and watch it. You know, it's available online there in full. It's an absolute work of art. And I think the great thing about that game is, as well, is that the Netherlands gave as good as they got physically.
Yeah.
You know, I think they knew that they had to, you know, they had to stand up to the physical aspect of that game. Otherwise, they could have been steamrollers out of the tournament. But no, the Netherlands were as vicious at times as the Brazilians were. There's some truly ugly challenges there. There's punches thrown. There's two-footed challenges, you know. And the style, for want of a better word, that Luis Pereira you know, gets himself sent off and then responds to it by kind of like offering out the crowd, basically, on his way off the pitch. It really is a work of art. And guy's right, you know, it's you know, an absolute, you know, just a good job that they weren't wearing yellow that night, Brazil. But, you know, it was, I mean, that Brazilian side just was such a, yeah, there was a reason why Brazil were like that in 74, you know, and Zagallo was very, very wary of World Cups on European soil. You know, he'd won as a player in Switzerland in 58. They played beautiful football. They were welcomed with open arms. You know, he won in Chile 4 years later, and he wasn't a player in 66 when Brazil went to England, and England were, you know, in England, Brazil were kicked out of the tournament. There was no two ways about it. So, you know, Zagallo went into 74 with 66 in mind, but it played for an ugly tournament. They were not pretty to watch. You know, they took pot shots from distance, and they played a safety first, you know, and then get your punches in first and ask the questions later kind of attitude, which was just, in a way, you know, hypnotic in itself. You know, it was anti-hypnotism, basically, Brazil, the 1974 World Cup. And, you know, I wrote an article about them and how they went from the beauty of 70 to the beast of 74, and set out the reasons why. And there was reasons. There were valid, you know, valid reasoning. But it wasn't needed by 74. People would have loved to have seen a more free-flowing Brazil, and they could have played a lot better than they did. But yeah, it just set up this de facto semi-final that wasn't quite a semi-final, but it was almost like rather than a World Cup semi-final, it was like a heavyweight boxing contest, and within the same calendar year as kind of like Muhammad Ali fighting George Foreman. You know, what you'd be better off doing, find yourself a Friday evening, watch Brazil versus the Netherlands, and then watch Ali versus Foreman.
Genius. The difference.
Yeah. And then tell me which was the more brutal and sporting event.
Okay, so we'll forget the prize fight of the semi, well, a de facto semi-final, if you like. And then, you know, Gary, you know, we've come to the final. We, you know, we've still got plenty of time. We've got another sort of 15, 20 minutes yet to sort of discuss the final and the legacy and the aftermath and favourite moments and all those sorts of things. So we're right where we should be in terms of timing. So, you know, we get to the final. It's hosts versus everybody else's favourites, if you like. Starts wonderfully, and take it from there.
Yeah, I remember this final so well, and, you know, as I just alluded to earlier, not many minutes have gone, and Cruyff picks the ball up, dances through the defence, and is brought down for a penalty. Neiskin smashes it right down the centre, and the first time that a German player touched the ball was when it was fetched out to the onion bag, and they're a goal down. The final, it almost makes me weep a little bit. I mean, metaphorically, and almost truly does. For the loss, you know, after scoring so early, instead of destroying the Germans, and I think they actually could have done that if they'd had that a ruthlessness about them, but they weren't ruthless. They were artists. They just decided they were sort of preening themselves in the mirror metaphorically. They wanted to admire how good they were, and they wanted to select from a delicate, delectable menu of ways of picking apart their opponents. They were the gods of counterculture. Cigarette-smoking footballers, geniuses from a country with a population just a shade over 13 million. But they were gods with wax wings. They flew too close to the sun, convinced their own invincibility and their innate right not only to win, but to do so in a way of their own choosing, by their own design. In the end, as they admired themselves and their beauty, the Germans stole the game away from them, you know, Vorsprung der Technik, as they never say in Amsterdam, ever. You know, progress through technology defeated the glorious, unapologetic strut of the artist. In that vital period, the latter part of the first half, when after Neeskens had scored and the Dutch had spent some time looking in the mirror, when the Germans first equalised and then took the lead, I come back to the absence of Hultzoff. Would they have had that space? Would they have had that those chances in the air, if he'd have been there, you know, this was, Hahn was perhaps exposed a little bit, but his defensive naivety, not his fault. He was a midfield player. But if Hulsoft would have been there, would he have made the task more difficult? Absolutely, definitely he would. Would it have changed the game? Probably. I don't know how far, but I'm sure it would. And in the second half, and I'll come to the end of the game in a little bit, but when the Dutch were pouring forward, having Hulsoft to play further forward, it would have made a lot of difference as well. You know, and any picture portrayed in a jigsaw puzzle with a missing piece could never be anything but frustrating. Not because it's poorer without it, but because with it, it could have been perfect. Falling one step short of the title, also, strangely, we referred to earlier, could also be rewarding as well as frustrating. Being a people's champion is fine, but dining at the top table is surely the ultimate reward. And had Hulsoft not suffered that knee injury and taken his place in the Dutch team on that day in Munich, I firmly believe the history of football would have been very different. Because without him, the Orange was incomplete. Total football just wasn't total. And there's a quote, and I mentioned the counterculture of the Dutch team earlier, and there's a quote from Jack Kerouac's book, On the Road. Jack Kerouac, who was one of the leaders of the counterculture system in America. And he sums up why that Dutch team was so special. The book was published in 1957, but this speech, this passage by the main character of the book, Sal Paradisi, wonderfully captures my joy of the Dutch team in 1970. So just bear with me, it's a very short quotation. The only people that interest me are the mad ones, the ones who are mad to live, mad to talk, desirous of everything at the same time, the ones that can never yawn or say a commonplace thing, but burn, like Roman candles across the night. Now, to me, that was exactly how the Dutch were. But the final few minutes of that game was almost like the dream bleeding to death. They almost gave up the beautiful football and ended up lumping balls into the area, the German area where they were sort of dealt with by the muscular Schwarzen Beck and the elegant Beckenbauer. And they almost ended up not playing their own game. And this is why I mentioned about if Hulsoft had been there, then that tactic might have worked more. But it's almost like the dream bled to death in those last few minutes.
Hey. I was going to ask you for your opinion of the final, Stephen, but I'm not overly convinced what you're actually going to be able to say after that. I've never listened to a more passionate eulogy about a game of football in my life. And I've listened to Gary quite a lot, to be fair. I don't know. Stephen, what are your thoughts on the final?
I'm still kind of like, you know, out in the ether there with Gary. I'll come back in a bit.
I suppose a question to ask then is, you know, the way he played was, you know, was incredible, and, you know, and Gary makes these, you know, these wonderful points, these wonderful analogies. But when, I suppose, to bring it down into slightly less artistic terms, when it really mattered, when they really needed to be able to play their game, they didn't or couldn't. And now, is that the lack of, you know, as we talked right at the beginning, is that the lack of tournament football? Is it the lack of, and I know that, you know, the club sides have played in European finals for their clubs, but, you know, was it a lack of that big moment experience that maybe that just needed somebody to get them back to playing the way that had served them so well in the previous, you know, in the previous games?
I think for me what happened was that everything that went for them, everything that they built their strength on, the fact that only 12 players had played throughout the tournament, you know, everyone, you know, 10 players started every single game, you know, one player only missed one game, and that strength was undone going into the final. You know, Rensenbrink wasn't fit. He took that much of a kick again in the Brazil game that he was... You know, he wasn't expected to play in the final, and he did. He took to the field in the final, but he wasn't fit, and he lasted till half time, and he was replaced by Rennie van der Kerkhoff. So even when it came down to replacing Rensenbrink, he wasn't replaced with the player that had slotted in for him against Sweden. You know, it wasn't Piet Keizer that came on. So, you know, there was a disorientation there from that alone. disorder. But there was also, there were newspaper scandals. There were stories of kind of like the Dutch squad kind of like, you know, having parties with topless models in the pool and all that kind of thing. So there was a huge kind of like, you know, this kind of like bomb had gone off. So it was, you know, an unsettling experience, I think, for them going into the final. And yes, they wanted to win the final under their own terms. They wanted to, you know, there's so much history as well, you know, such, you know, what was still at that time, you know, less than 30 years. I mean, we were saying that before, 30 years since Liverpool won the title, and here we are. But we're talking, this was 29 years after the end of the Second World War, so it's a shorter time span than that, you know, to say, well, look, this nation that had invaded them, and it does come down to that, a lot of it. I mean, I used to work with a Dutchman who was at Euro 88, and he made the trip for that semi-final in Hamburg, and just, you know, he said even his generation that were brought up by the parents and the grandparents of just what had happened in the war, and it was personal. So there was a personal aspect to it. You know, people make so much of the war aspect with England-Germany games, which it becomes a pantomime as such. But, you know, there was still a raw nature to that as far as the Dutch were concerned, and they wanted to really rub the Germans' noses in it. They wanted to rub West Germany's noses and to embarrass them. They wanted to humiliate them. And Cruyff himself had said this in many interviews, saying that, you know, we didn't just want to beat them, we wanted to humiliate them. And in the end, they took their eye off the prize. So when Germany came back and equalised, you know, you've got to understand this is a, you know, the reigning European champions. Why wouldn't they be in the game? But it was also a German side that had flipped the coin. You know, they had started the tournament with that question mark over Netzer. Should he be playing? Shouldn't he be playing? He remained an omnipresent figure throughout the group stages. He only made one appearance as a substitute against East Germany. They'd lost the game. So by the time they got to the second round group stage, the question had been asked, no, it doesn't need to be Netzer. Netzer shouldn't be playing. And Overath had an absolutely fantastic tournament. He was the man that was missing in 72. He played in the World Cup in 66. He played in 70. You know, he was more of a percentage playing attacking midfielder than Netzer was. But he was the right man for the job for them. And as I said it earlier in the hour, was that, you know, in 74, West Germany got the job done. And the team that went out for them in that 1974 final were primed to do it. And it was, there was no more question marks over that side by the time they got to the final. The team was picking itself by then, and it didn't quite work that way for the Dutch, and the fact that Rensenbrink wasn't fit. And there were, it was where you found out that, you know, Barry Hulshof was badly missed.
Gary, it's, you know, I suppose, you know, we always knew how this story was going to end. We always knew, you know, the outcome for this side and this side that you've chosen. Obviously, it's not, and rightly so, it's not stopped you from picking them. But, you know, we talk about the aftermath, and when we do it as a major tournament, you know, you sort of have to wait. If it's a European side, you have to wait 2 years for the European Championships or 4 years for the next World Cup. And sometimes the aftermath can almost be a completely different picture to the tournament that we've talked about. But there's almost this tragedy of repetition, if you like, with regards to what happens after 1974.
Yeah, there's a quote. One of my sort of favourite books is Brilliant Orange by David Winner, because a lot obviously covers a lot of this tournament. And there's a quote by Cruyff in there. I'll just chuck it in. So he says, this is after the tournament, we were very successful in a way because we were acclaimed for our style, and everybody said we were the best team. But it deflected the attention from the failure. Over the years, became an excuse. The Dutch thing became beautiful losing. And it's strange, but I understand it and I appreciate it, and I almost strangely celebrate in it. And I sort of go back to that sort of thing that I mentioned before, that, you know, is winning everything, or is being the best better than winning? And, you know, to me, the Dutch team in 1974 were the best team. certainly, you know, they should have won a final because they were the better team. With or without Barry Holsoff, they were the better team. 1978, 4 years later, the Dutch were in the final again. A different Dutch team, but with, still with so many of the players from that the early tournament. You know, Kroll was there still. Rensen Brinker, we mentioned earlier, was still there. And again, they came up short in a World Cup final. The Dutch are the only team, only country to get to 3 World Cup finals and lose them all. You know, I mean, how sort of almost character defining is that? You know, obviously the recent one, there was no sort of players. This is obviously in South Africa and Spain beat them. There was no players who were from the same heritage, and that the Dutch team then weren't hardly as entertaining as the teams in 74 and 78. But there's almost this thing now in Dutch football, and it's obviously the European Championships when Nicholls got them over the line is an exception. But there's this thing about being the beautiful bridesmaid rather than the bride.
I absolutely agree with you, Gary. You know, it's, you know, we sort of come back to this point. You know, we've done a couple of podcasts about the Hungarian side of 54. We know my obsession was Brazil 82. You know, we know Stephen's love of 86, and you know, and your love of the Dutch 74. And between us, we've won nothing, and yet, you know, and yet it's almost you know, this is what this exact series is. It's why we love the game. We love the game because of these sides, or the impact that these sides had on us, or watching these sides. And yet, like I say, they've won nothing between them, but they almost, their impact is so much bigger. You know, and Stephen was right. You know, it's so much bigger than being a tournament winner. It's, you know, the legacy is almost infinite. It, you know, it's still being felt. You know, the Hungarian legacy is still being felt. The Dutchies, the Brazilians are, you know, the Danish are. It's almost more tangible than a winner's medal for the side that win it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and you're absolutely right. It's the legacy they leave behind isn't about medals. It's about admiration. It's about celebration. It's about having something to treasure, something to cherish, something that you think is beautiful. And this is true of the guys, you know, your favourites of Brazil 82, and Steve is of the Danish Dynamite team. You know, and going back even further to the Hungarians, they were a beautiful team to watch. They were all beautiful teams to watch, not necessarily the teams that won the tournaments, but the best teams to watch. And, you know, let's almost lose the last two words, the best teams as well.
Yeah, it is. Stephen, any sort of last thoughts before I get you both to discuss your standout moments from this side in this tournament?
Yeah, no, Gary's nailed it there. It is beauty within failure when push comes to shove. And I don't know, would we love those sides as much as we do if they'd have won those tournaments? Who knows? You know, because I suppose to say that, you know, what are our favourite winning teams? You know, maybe that's something for another podcast, the ones that did win.
Oh.
Where do you start with that? You know, we've spoken about so many of those sides, but yeah, it's always the ones that just fall short. You know, you can, for me, you can have the Soviet Union 88, Euro 88, you know, Belanov, Protasov, and you know, all of those, you know, transfixed by those sides and those games and those goals, and it's the movement of the teams, and it's everything that captivates and captures the heart and stirs the soul. And Gary has absolutely, you know, his descriptions and the evocative kind of like feelings for this wonderful side that the Netherlands put together in 1974, you know, speaks for itself.
Okay. It's always sad to end these. Like I say, there are such wonderful discussions, mainly because the passion that's engendered from the guest is always it just sets the tone for the whole sort of hour and a bit. And you know, and again, Gary, obviously, you know, you like I say, we're all together. You know, those guys are together all week. Every week. But you know, it's still almost like a different version of you when we hear you talk about either the Dutch club sides of the 70s or, you know, the Dutch national sides, and it's why it works. It's why these sorts of conversations work. But I am going to have to pin you down for a most memorable moment from this side.
Okay. Because you let me on twice, and so I'm going to cheat a little bit.
Might as well now.
I wouldn't say I'm going to go for two, but actually I'm going to go for three. So I'll be brief. So first one I'd say was, and the YouTube klaxon, have a look at Crowe's first goal against Argentina. Wonderful, wonderful. The second one would be, take a look at the Cruyff turn against Sweden. Hypnotic, absolutely hypnotic. And the final one I'd say was the most important one. You know, and notwithstanding Stevie's comment that, you know, the Dutch were physical enough to look after themselves, there was action and there was reaction. The action came from Brazilians, and when the Dutch beat them, that was beauty slaying the beast.
Brilliant, Stephen. I am going to ask you. I'm going to ask you for yours in just one second. But as a child, we were quite late getting a video recorder. I am going somewhere with this. We were quite late getting a video recorder, and I can remember when we got it, and there was it was great World Cup moments was one of the videos, and I can remember pausing the Cruyff turn, and I can remember I sort of paused and play and pause and play and pause and play like you did then, and I can remember trying to find the exact point of when the defender realised that Cruyff wasn't where he thought he was, and where Cruyff actually was, and the distance. And again, it's a lot easier now for the YouTube generation, but when you do watch the Cruyff turn, try and pause it on the moment where the defender suddenly realises that Cruyff's not where he should be and how far Johan Cruyff has actually gone in the other direction with the ball. Because it's almost an interminable amount of time before he realises where it's gone. That was just my video recording skills of the mid-80s. But there you go.
Just very briefly, Stu, there. That moment is almost like a frozen moment in time of the Dutch at that tournament. It was beauty, yep. But he couldn't score from it in the end. He never got the final result.
Yeah, you are absolutely right. You are absolutely right, Gary. Stephen, for you, the final magical moment.
I think Gary's he's bracketed them there. I mean, that Argentina game is an absolute masterclass of a performance, and just in football, in movement, it's a beautiful thing. And yes, the Brazil game, and I think the Brazil game is the fact it's the goals for me, as much as the violence, which is a work of art in itself. And Gary's right. The action and the reaction, you know, the counter punch and the punch and the counter punch, you know, are fantastic to watch. You know, don't do this at home, kids, but just watch this. It's great. The two goals that won the game were beautiful, and I think that's one of the great things about that game is just how startlingly beautiful the two goals were within this sea of violence. It's just kind of like hypnotic. And yes, the Cruyff turn, you know, the most iconic World Cup moments ever, perhaps. You know, just and you're right, that moment of bewilderment from the defender for Sweden is just again another iconic moment.
You know, guys, like I say, it's been great. I have the absolute privilege of listening to you two, like I say, on a regular basis, talk about the things that I absolutely love. Gary, you've been just as good as I knew you would be.
Thank you, and it's been a fantastic opportunity to sort of talk to people about the greatest team that never won the World Cup. Sorry, guys, I'm done with you.
Yeah, I'll edit that bit out. That's fine.
I'll tell you what you need to do, Stu. Stu, you need to write a book, to kind of like, you know, counter that argument.
I think you're absolutely right. I should get on that.
You need to get on to that, Stu.
I'll tell you something afterwards. It's funny you mentioned that.
Stephen, you know, it's great, like I said before, isn't it? It's the passion of the guest that makes this work.
It is. It's absolutely fantastic. You know, the joy and the love that people have for the teams that they come and talk about, it's just properly kind of like infectious.
So all that's left for me to say is thank you to the listeners for joining us on another episode of the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. And please be sure to join us again next time. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.